in 12 years. Okay, there we go. Now that button's blinking. I probably screwed that up. Sorry, Anna. Anyway, all right, so 1-1. David is old, advanced in years, obviously, and he's literally on his deathbed at this point, okay? Verse 2, his servant said to him, let the king seek a young virgin for my lord the king that he may, that she may attend to the king and become his nurse, and let her lie in your bosom, and may the Lord, and may my lord the king keep warm. So they give this this woman, we find out in verse, where is her name? 3, her name is Abishag the Shunammite, and she's basically a... she's a professional cuddler. Have you guys seen those on the internet? Okay, that's what she is. That is the oddest job ever. Good Lord. Have you guys seen that? It's like a serious job. I hope none of you have seen that because you're not doing it. But yes, there are people that out there, they get paid to cuddle with other people. Yeah, so I don't know. So it would take a lot of money, I think, for, yeah. Just can't imagine. But yeah, it's a purely platonic thing, apparently, but there's people that are paid to go cuddle with other people. This is what Abishag the Shunammite did. Thousands of years before it was popular on Facebook, okay? She's a nurse. It says very clearly, verse 4, the girl was beautiful. She became the king's nurse and served him, but the king did not cohabit with her, which is assumptive of what David would have done with the other women in his life, which was cohabit with them, okay? So that was, or have sex with them, okay? In case we're mixing words here. So this is as good a relationship, I guess, as you can have, but the idea is that she's kind of the last gal in David's life that's going to serve as a nurse to him, take care of him, keep him warm, and serve his needs. But she's also going to be a figurehead. So just remember that gal's name, Abishag the Shunammite. Okay, that's the gal that they have given to David now for a nurse. Okay, now, verse 5, let's pick up there. Somebody read. All right, so we got Adonijah, who is one of David's sons. He came after Absalom, so I think he's like fifth born. But who's supposed to be the next king? Solomon, right? We know that. David has communicated that at least internally. Externally, we're not sure, but Adonijah sees an opportunity. So dad's on his deathbed, and David hasn't made any type of public presentation of who's the next king's going to be. Okay, why would you suppose that is? Why has David failed to lead in this area? Maybe. What have we seen as David's kind of MO in regards to passivity? Yeah, he's been passive, and he's being passive here again, and he hasn't made it clear. So he's about to cause another ruckus in his family because he won't lead. He won't say, hey, Solomon's my guy. He's the guy that's going to lead. And for whatever reason, Solomon's the guy, but I mean, it could have been any of his sons, right? God promised him a house, a legacy from his home. So any of his sons, I suppose, would have done. But for whatever reason, was it God saying it was Solomon or what have you? This is the guy that's supposed to lead. Adonijah sees an opportunity and he steps up, okay? And he's cunning. He's very similar to his brother Absalom. He's going to win the hearts of the people, and he's going to try to now take the kingship. And he says, I will be king. Verse 5, he prepares chariots and horses. As Haley read, and he's basically making his own parade. He's going to have his own little, parade of kingship here, okay? And not only that, in verse 6 and 7, Haley, keep rolling and watch who he rallies with him.
His father had never at any time displeased him by asking, why have you done this? And so he was also a very handsome man, and he was born next after Absalom.
What does that mean, that his father had never crossed him at any time asking, why have you done so? Like, why wouldn't David say, dude, what are you doing? You know my heart is to have Solomon king, but this guy knows. What type of kid do you think? Spoiled. He's spoiled rotten, right? He knows there may be verbal threats. There may be, hey, if you do that one more time, I'm gonna, but there's no follow through on David's side. So he knows, man, there's no consequences. I can do whatever I want, right? It's great being spoiled until you realize what spoiled really means. Like, this kid is Jack, and he's going to pay the consequences for that. And this honestly is on David, and it's on his failure to lead. He has raised a kid that has no boundaries. Okay, boundaries are healthy, and they are helpful. So, verse 7, keep rolling, Haley. So who does he get on his team?
Joab.
Why would Joab be on his team?
Because Joab
You think he's a little bit ticked at David for putting him on the bench? And, you know, David's been, he's publicly kind of humiliated him. We never see a private conversation between the two. Clearly isn't restored. They aren't back in the good graces of one another. Joab wouldn't have gone with this guy. David's still alive, right? He's seen other coups. When Absalom revolted, Joab stayed with David. He didn't go with Absalom. So Joab is obviously angry, and there's still bad blood between the two. And he says, great, you know, David, you're as good as dead to me. I'm going with your son that he'd be king. And Abiathar was the priest. We've got two priests at the time. So he wins the heart of Abiathar to go now with Adonijah. So this is not good. And they helped him become priest. Zadok, however, verse 8, the son of Jehoiada, Nathan the prophet, the same Nathan from back in 1 Samuel, Shimei, Re, the mighty men of David were not with Adonijah. These guys stay, along with a guy by the name of Benaiah, who's mentioned somewhere coming up. But Benaiah, the guy that was killed a lion in a pit on a snowy day, the guy from yesterday in chapter 23 of 2 Samuel, he stays with David as well. He's faithful, and he's going to be a faithful lieutenant, or commander rather, to Solomon as we move forward. So we're seeing the beginnings of now another coup underneath David. We've seen this over and over. This is the third, maybe the fourth one we've seen underneath his reign. And David is at fault here because he's not leading well. Okay? Watch what Adonijah does now in verse 9. All right, so what's he doing in verse 9? What do you call that? What is he?
Idol worship.
Not idol worship at this point.
Self-coronation?
Yeah, he's exactly what he's doing. He's hosting his own party, sending out invitations, and then he's inviting everybody to it. Like, it's a little awkward. Who does he not invite?
The good guy.
Yeah, and he invites all his brothers except Solomon. So does he know who David wants to be king? Absolutely. That's why he doesn't invite Solomon and all the people that would have been on the other team, Benaiah and the other guys. So he's just kind of self-coordinating himself. Let's do this, okay? But Nathan the prophet spoke to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and said, hey, have you not heard that Adonijah, the son of Haggith, has become king? David, our Lord, does not know it. So this is going on. So come, let's fix this situation. So Nathan says, man, here's what we're going to do. Bathsheba, you're going to go to David. You're going to tell him what's happening. You're going to walk through this story. And then immediately, when you're finished telling this to David as the mother of Solomon, I'm going to walk in behind you and confirm your story and say exactly the same thing. So they're just delivering the truth to David. Okay, so they kind of hash out this plan. He says, go at once, verse 13, to King David. Communicate this story and do that. Okay, so Bathsheba, verse 15, goes to the king in his bedroom. So he's literally, again, on his deathbed with Abishag, the Shunammite, ministering to the king in verse 15. She comes in verse 16, bows down and tells this story. Verse 17, my lord, you swore to your maidservant by the Lord your God, saying, surely your son Solomon shall be king after me and shall sit on my throne. David, you've made this clear. Those are your intentions, yes? Okay, we're clear on that. Now behold, verse 18, Adonijah is king, and now my lord the king, you do not know it. He sacrificed oxen, fatlings, sheep in abundance. He's invited all the sons of the king, and Abiathar the priest, and Joab the commander of the army, but he has not invited Solomon, your servant. As you know, my lord the king, the eyes of all Israel are on you. Tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. David, everybody's waiting for you to lead, for you to make an edict, and for you to speak. And because of your passivity and your silence, you're creating a coup, okay? So David is, you see again, this root struggle with him of just, he's a little late to the party every time. Yeah.
So was Adonijah the one that was sacrificing it, or was it like through Abiathar?
Probably through Abiathar, but he's certainly the one that is saying, let's throw me a big party, okay? So he's certainly leading it, okay? So she speaks clearly and again is wise in the way she does it and basically says in 21, otherwise it will come about as soon as my lord the king sleeps with his fathers that my son will be considered offender. So my family, if Adonijah is going to take over, he's going to extinguish the other sons in order to prevent an uprising or a coup from coming, David, after you're dead. So, man, you need to do something. Okay. 22, Nathan comes in, shares the exact same story, walks through all of that until verse 28. And basically, these two, Bathsheba and Nathan, call David kind of to accountability and say, listen, you need to do something. And in verse 28, David decides to act. Okay, let's continue there. 1 Kings 1:28. All right, so he draws a line in the sand and says, yep, that's my intention. I said your son, Solomon, my son Solomon will reign after me. That is the case, so that's what we're going to do, okay? Bathsheba bows down with her face to the ground in verse 31. It says, my lord, the king David, live forever. Verse 32, David now says, Haley, keep going to 32. Gihon. Mm-hmm. Gihon is a spring in Israel. It's one of the water sources around Jerusalem.
And let Zadok the priest and Nathan the prophet there anoint him king over Israel. Then blow the trumpet and say, long live King Solomon.
All right, so David's plan is, hey, he's going to ride on my mule. It will be seen. He'll put on kind of my robes, my crown, that sort of thing. We're going to have our own procession. So Adonijah's having his. We're going to have our own. We're going to put the official stamp of approval on Solomon, not Adonijah. And we're going to take Benaiah, who's now my new Joab. We're going to take the other high priest, Zadok, who's still with me. And we're going to take those kind of sorts of people to make this official. Okay. Then you shall come up, verse 35, after him. He shall come and sit on my throne and be king in my place. For I have appointed him to be ruler over Israel and Judah. So they are now forced, or David is now forced to act, and he's going to do it. Okay. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, answered the king and said, amen. In verse 36, thus may the Lord, the God of my Lord, the king, say. Okay, so they're affirming what this is. These guys are on Solomon's team. Verse 39, Zadok then took the horn of oil from the tent and anointed Solomon. They blew the trumpet and all the people said, long live King Solomon. So this happens. They anoint Solomon with the horn of oil, just like they did with David, just like they did with Saul way back in the day when Samuel anointed him. So there's an official process with a king, with a priest, the prophets that are there and all that would have been a part of this. Okay, so Solomon is now anointed king. Now, 41, as Adonijah is in the middle of his own like keg party, watch what happens. So literally, they're all like in a room patting themselves on the back, you know, like, hey, we had a coup. It's all good. And they go, what's that uproar in Jerusalem? Like, there's a party going on there. What is, you guys hear that? While he was still speaking, 42, Jonathan, the son of Abiathar, the priest, comes in and says, man, I got bad news. 43, Jonathan replied to Adonijah, man, our Lord King David has made Solomon king. Whoops. You're out here having your own king party. The official king's over there. You basically just declared what team you're on. This is not good for us, okay? And everyone that thought that they had been on the winning team and been a part of this coup have now clearly aligned themselves with the wrong horse in the race. So this is a bad deal. So they get news that that's the case. Let's see. They get more of this noise. They hear about what's going on, that Solomon's been anointed. Verse 48, the king also said thus, blessed be the Lord, the God of Israel, who has granted one of mine to sit on the throne, speaking now of Solomon. Verse 49, rather, pick up there.
So all the guests who were with Adonijah were afraid and rose and went his own way.
All right, so party breaks up pretty quickly. Everybody realizes we're in a bad spot. Keep going, Will, in 50.
Now Adonijah was afraid of Solomon, so he rose and he took hold of his horns of the altar.
All right, so Adonijah now realizes, man, I'm in a bad spot. And what does he do?
And it was told to Solomon.
Hold on, 50. What does that What does that mean? That he rose and took hold of the horns of the altar. We've talked about that before. What altar are we speaking of? Where do we see altars? The altar. This is the tabernacle, okay? This is where it should have been, at least. The tabernacle's not there, but the elements of the tabernacle, again, are with David. So he's got, in the at least in the city, in the old city of Jerusalem that David now has established, he has the Ark of the Covenant, right? He brought that in. The tabernacle is in Gibeon, okay? So Adonijah flees there and goes to the altar that would have been outside where you slayed the animals. And basically, it's like base, okay? I'm on the altar, you can't touch me, okay? Exodus chapter 21? No. 34. It's in there. In Exodus, it talks about fleeing to the horns of the altar and that there are times that someone could basically say, they're communicating, hey, this is where I offer sacrifice. God has forgiven me. You should forgive me too. So he's saying basically, I have no case. Like, I'm hosed. I'm just begging for mercy at this point. So he runs knowing that he's done wrong and he's asking for grace from Solomon not to kill him. Okay, so that's the picture of what's going on. And we'll see this kind of throughout this story with him and with other guys as well. Okay, but apparently this was an accepted practice when you realized you had no other course of action than to just beg for mercy. Where are they at? Where do you see them? I'm sorry.
Back in
44. Yeah, I don't know. They would have been smaller groups of, I don't know, like family lines in the area. Why they're pointed out, I don't know, of what significance. So I'd have to look into that. So Adonijah now flees, and we're going to see how Solomon is going to handle this. Okay, so we're about to watch him deal with adversity in the kingdom and splits and how he's going to take care of this. 51 now, this is the word that comes from him.
Told to Solomon, saying, "Indeed, Adonijah is afraid of King Solomon, for look, he has taken hold of the horns of the altar, saying, 'Let King Solomon swear to me today that he will not put his servant to death with the sword.'" And then Solomon said, "If he proves himself a worthy man, not one hair of him shall fall to the earth. But if wickedness is found in him, he shall die." So King Solomon sent them to bring him down to from the altar. And he came and fell down before King Solomon. And Solomon said to him, "Go to your house."
All right. So how does Solomon handle him? What do you see? What does Solomon have the right to do at this point, technically? Kill him. He could kill him if he wanted to. He certainly has the power. He's about to. He could have him killed. But what does he say?
He gives him an opportunity to prove himself.
Yeah. If he handles himself appropriately, he's not a threat to me. Okay? Go home. Go to your house. No problem. However, if you choose to act stupid, then there's going to be consequences of that. So he very clearly draws a line in the sand. So he's not after blood or vengeance. It's not this, man, I'm going to get a pound of flesh in this moment. He doesn't need that. So he draws a line in the sand and says, listen, you handle yourself appropriately and you and I can be fine moving forward. You screw up and there's going to be consequences to that. Okay, so you're seeing some qualities in Solomon. I just want you to take note of, right? So coup is put down. Solomon's been anointed as king. Chapter 2 now, David is about to die. And he's going to give a phenomenal father-son speech to his son Solomon, who at this point is about 20 or 21 years of age. Okay, just to give you an idea. He'll reign again for another 40 years. But at this point, man, he's a young man. And his now 70-year-old father is going to speak life into him as he's handing the baton to him. So just want you to take note of this, especially guys. If you didn't get this sort of thing from your dad, as I didn't, this is the type of things that your sons and your daughters will need from a dad. This is fantastic. Okay? 2:1.
"Now the days of David drew near, and that he should die. And he charged Solomon his son, saying, 'Go, I go the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and prove yourself a man.'"
All right. So, Solomon, it's time to be a man. Okay, your boy days are over. You need to step up and you need to be a man. Okay, from this point forward, you're about to lead the most powerful nation on the entire earth. You need to step up and be a man. Okay, and this is what I mean by that. Verse 3.
"Keep the charge of the Lord, walk in his ways and to keep his statutes, his commandments, his judgments, his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, that you may prosper in all that you do wherever you turn.
Okay, now summarize that for me. Is David is communicating to Solomon, this is what it means for you to be a man, this is what it means for you to lead. What is he saying? Walk with God, okay? Humbly, know his statutes, his ordinances, know what the book says, and walk with God, okay? That's what he's saying, okay? Verse 4, so that the Lord may carry out his promise, which he spoke concerning me, saying, if your sons are careful of their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart, with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. Obedience. It's the same thing that Joshua commanded the people with as they came into the land. Walk with God. Just obey. This isn't rocket science, okay? There's not a list of things. This isn't, it isn't hard in terms to figure out. It is difficult, right? You're going to have to walk with God and make hard decisions, but Solomon, walk with God. Okay, so this godly king of David, who's the greatest king that's ever reigned, says now to his son, who's taking the baton, Solomon, this is what I want for you. Be a man and walk with God. Okay, now watch what else David does. I think this is fascinating, how he speaks to him. Okay, verse 5, he's going to give Solomon some instructions. And I want you to notice how he does this. Verse 5, pick up there.
Moreover,
Amasa, yeah. And we know those stories, right? Joab murdered these guys. And Solomon's reminding, or David's reminding Solomon, hey, this is an issue, okay? Keep going.
Whom he killed, and he shed the blood of war. He shed the blood of war in peacetime and put the blood of war on his belt and was found around his waist and his and on his sandals that were on his feet.
So by the way, how does David interpret Joab's actions? He committed war in a time of peace. It wasn't appropriate. So David knows it. He won't act on it, but he knows it's wrong. Okay? Now, watch this. Verse 6. So act according to your wisdom, and do not let his gray hair go down to Sheol in peace. So what does he command Solomon to do? What does he tell him?
Make sure he dies before his time.
You need to deal with him. He needs to... Justice needs to be enacted. Does he tell Solomon how to do this? No. Why is that important? And what does he refer to in this text? What does David see in Solomon at 21?
Wisdom.
He said, man, this guy has something special. I see a quality in him. He knows how to navigate life. He's wise at a very young age. I don't need to tell Solomon how to do this. I don't need to micromanage his kingdom, but he gives him big picture mountaintops and says, deal with this, and deal with this. Okay, this is kind of the baggage left over from my kingdom. I'm not going to tell you, Solomon, how to do that. You're wise and you're discerning. You'll figure it out. As a father to a son, why is that so important?
It's affirming that he trusts what he can do.
Yeah. I don't need to tell you how to do this. In fact, I trust Solomon that you'll handle this better than I would according to your wisdom. So he's affirming qualities that he sees in his son. You with me? That's big. Okay. Every son needs that. Every daughter needs that from their dad. I love you. I believe in you. And I think you're good at this. Okay. Kids need that from their parents. It breathes life into them. Okay. My kids ask me constantly, what they think I think they're good at, right? They want to know, Daddy, am I good at that? Am I good at this? What do you know? They want to be affirmed in those areas. Is it math? Is it running? It's all over the map in terms of what they desire, but they're wanting an affirmation from their parents that I'm good at something, that I'm unique and I'm different from my other sisters around me. And you're seeing David call out Solomon's wisdom. And we're about to see Solomon put that on display. He indeed at 21 is wise beyond his years. So I love the way that David handles him. He gives him a metric to live by, walk with God. And Solomon, use the qualities that God has given you. You are wise. Walk in wisdom as you handle these things, okay? Verse 6 again, act according to wisdom, okay? And then he goes on. So you're going to have to deal with Joab. Verse 7, but show kindness to the sons of Barzillai, okay, the Gileadite, and let them be among those who eat at your table, for they assisted me when I fled from Absalom, your brother. Who is that guy? Do you remember? Barzillai. He was the 80-year-old dude that's like, man, David, I'd love to go with you as you're fleeing from Absalom, but man, I can't even hear anymore. I can barely see. I can't taste food. Don't take this wrong way, but I'm gonna stay here, and it's not because I'm aligning myself with Absalom, okay? My servants and my sons will go after you. So David's reminding him, hey, it may have looked like he stayed here. He didn't, okay? I trust his heart, so be gracious to him and be gracious to his family. So he reminds him of that. However, verse 8, there's another dude that wasn't so gracious. Verse 8, read that.
See, you have... son of Jireh, the Benjamite from Barum, who cursed me with a malicious curse in the day when I went to Mahanaim.
Okay, you remember that guy that was the cursing mooner that walked with David out of town, and basically, I mean, David uses some pretty strong language, a violent curse, cursed me with a violent curse. He says, man, we're going to deal with this guy. David says, I swore to him by the Lord, saying, I will not put you to death with the sword. So David says, I gave my word that I wouldn't kill him, but I didn't give my word that you wouldn't kill him. So he basically says, do not let him go unpunished. So you need to deal with him. I committed to something, and I'm going to stick by my word. However, Solomon, again, you are a wise man. Listen to this. You will know what you ought to do with him, and you will bring his gray hair down to Sheol with blood. Deal with him appropriately. Again, I'm not going to tell you how, but he's wronged me. Okay, he's wronged this kingdom. You need to deal with this. Okay, so he sees something in this guy that needs to be taken care of. And again, Solomon's going to handle it with wisdom.
So why do you think David didn't respond to those things in his kingdom? Because he's obviously upset about them. Even though he said he wouldn't kill Shammai, there's no forgiveness there.
I think there is. I think he sees something in him that's a potential issue. Because he's a Benjamite, because there's a potential coup, I think he's being discerning, saying, that guy's a problem. Like, I've gotten over it, but that doesn't remove the fact that that guy's got a wicked heart. And the reason he's cursing David leaving town is because he's from Benjamin and wants to see Saul's line restored. So he realizes, for Solomon's sake, that's an issue. So I think there's forgiveness. I think what David struggles with is when to act. David has the discernment to see issues, and some he'll step in and deal with, and others he doesn't know what to do. So part of it is like, you know what, man? I'm walking back in. God's given me the throne. Had he handled these little petty things and been, you know, bowed up his chest and said, kill that guy and kill that guy, politically it may not have been the best move. It would have offended the people. So I think he's trying to be discerning. But in places like with Joab, with Adonijah, you're seeing, man, you've moved past wise and discerning into passive, and your hard drive's locked up. You won't act. And I think that's where David gets into trouble, okay? So I appreciate that if David's going to fault on any side, I shouldn't say that, they're all bad. He's not ready, fire, aim, you know, like Peter. Peter just would have shot these guys and gotten it over with. There are certain other kings that we'll see that are probably more appropriate examples, would have just killed him immediately and said, the heck with it. Like Jehu, he's a king that's coming. He's like, kill everybody. Kill him now. Kill him yesterday, right? He just kills everybody, and that's the solution to everything. But he doesn't think and process and think through a godly lens. David's going to tend to wait and withhold action. But I think at the end of his life, he's realizing, man, I should have done something and I didn't. And Solomon, if you don't, these are going to be problems in your kingdom. So I think he's just trying to set him up for success, if you will. Okay? So that's my take. Okay? Not to forgive David in that for not dealing with it, but I think that's kind of where he's coming from. So you've got now David communicating kind of his last hurrah. Deal with now Adonijah appropriately. Deal with Joab. Deal with Shammai. Make sure you're gracious now to the people that you need to extend grace to Barzillai here in verse 7, but use your wisdom and know how to handle this, okay? Now in verse 10, David slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David. The days of David, that David reigned over Israel were 40 years, 7 years he reigned in Hebron, 33 years he reigned in Jerusalem, and Solomon sat on his throne, on the throne of King David his father, and the kingdom was firmly established. So at least in a sense, all ends well. We are now seeing that handoff made, exactly what needed to take place took place, okay? One of the odd things, by the way, about King David, because he wasn't a builder, because he didn't build things that lasted in terms of archaeologically, there's very, very little evidence that he ever existed, archaeologically speaking. And in fact, it wasn't until recently, I think 1994, they found in the city of Dan up north an inscription on the wall or something in that city that had David's name on it. It was the first time that they had found anything that actually connected King David to the city. And for years, people would say, this is bunk. I mean, a king for 40 years, the most powerful king in Israel, the most revered king ever in Israel, and you can't find one jar with his name on it, you can't find one letter that he signed, anything that would demonstrate that he was actually here. So liberal scholars were kind of tearing it apart, and then they began to unearth things, and they've unearthed more things at this point, but there's still not a lot of evidence, okay? Solomon, however, as a builder, he builds cities, he fortifies things, there's tons of stuff on him, okay? We see his thumbprint on everything, along with a guy by the name of Herod, who did the same thing during Jesus' day. So it's an odd deal. So he's buried in Jerusalem, in his tomb, in the old city. We have no idea where that is. So there's probably some guy's house named Muhammad that lives on top of King David's throne or grave, and they have no idea. And that's the nature of living in Israel, or living in Jerusalem specifically. Okay, so handoff has now been made. Now, 13, Solomon's going to have to deal with these issues that King David said he had to deal with. Okay, here's the first one, Adonijah in verse 13.
Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, came to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and she said, do you come peacefully? He said, peacefully. Then he said, I have something to say to you. She said, speak.
All right, so Adonijah, the guy that performed the coup, now comes to Bathsheba, who is not his mom. This is the mother of Solomon. And Adonijah has a request for her. And she's caught off guard. Hey, do you come peacefully? Which is a fair question. Like, you just raised a coup like yesterday. David's dead. Why do you want an audience with me? He says, no, I just have a request. And he said, you know that the kingdom was mine and that all Israel expected me to be king. No, they didn't. You had your own little party, and that's how that went down. However, the kingdom was turned about and has become my brother's, for it was from the Lord. So at least he acknowledges that. Now I am making one request of you. Do not refuse me. And she says, okay, what do you want? Verse 17, Max, keep reading there.
And he said, please ask King Solomon, he will not refuse you, to give me Abishag, the Shunammite, as my wife.
All right, so what does he ask Bathsheba for?
The cuddler.
The cuddler, the professional cuddler, okay? Because he's lonely and needs somebody to cuddle with, correct? Why would Adonijah be asking for Abishag, the Shunammite? She is a tool. She is a symbol. If I sleep with my father's concubine, then what? What's his intention? I'm taking the throne. I didn't get it this way. I'm going to get it that way. So this isn't some innocent, no, I just think she's really pretty and has a nice personality. I'd like to marry her. That's not at all what he's asking. She is a pawn in his game to achieve the throne. Okay, Bathsheba is like, woo, had no idea. So she's like, great, I'll speak to Solomon, I'll talk to him. Bathsheba went to King Solomon to speak for him and says, man, in verse 18, very well, I will speak to the king for you. She has no idea what his real intentions are. So he is cunning, he's deceptive. Now, what did Solomon say to Adonijah? What was his last words?
To Adonijah?
Yeah. Dude, you stay out of trouble, we're good, okay? Go home, go to your house, you know, carry on. If you don't show evil intentions, you and I are good, okay? What is he doing? He's showing some evil intentions, yes? And Solomon is going to clearly interpret what he's saying. Bathsheba now comes to Solomon, which is funny that he goes through the mom. Like, you know, we're about to find out if Solomon's controlled by his mom, if he's a mama's boy, or he's actually going to man up and lead like David called him to lead, and maybe that was part of it. Maybe you're going to see a very overly controlling mother here in a way that thinks now that she holds the keys to the kingdom, and there's going to be future mothers in the kingly line that lead through their sons. Their sons are just a pawn, and they're these kind of really strong, kind of contentious women that are trying to get their way through their son. So she's asking, I think in an innocent way, but she just doesn't get the big picture. She doesn't understand why Adonijah is asking for what he's asking. So she comes now and makes a request, and she says, hey, don't refuse me. King Solomon says, mother, ask whatever you want. Like, if I can take care of you and honor your request, I will not refuse you. 21, she says, let Abishag the Shunammite be given to Adonijah, your brother, as a wife. Okay, that's what I'm requesting of you, Solomon. 22, watch how Solomon answers.
King Solomon answered his mother, and why do you ask Abishag the Shunammite for Adonijah? Ask for him the kingdom also, for he is my older brother, and on his side are Abiathar the priest and Joab the son of Zeruiah.
So what is he, in this moment, in this split-second decision, what does he recognize? Why don't you just ask for the throne? He's not asking, mom, for a wife. He's asking for my crown. Do you not understand that? And she doesn't. So he's got Joab. He's got Abiathar the priest. Like, he has everything he needs. The only thing he lacks now is the crown, and this is his means to get that. So King Solomon swore by the Lord, saying in verse 23, may God do so to me, and more so, if Adonijah had not spoken this word against his own life. And he's basically saying, man, I told him if he handled himself appropriately, he wouldn't have an issue. He's done stupid, and now he's going to get the consequences to that. Now, Solomon is different than his dad. He's gracious, like David is, as long as he can be. And then when it requires action, he steps in and he acts firmly and decisively. Okay, 24, read that.
Now, therefore, as the Lord lives, who has established me and placed me on the throne of David, my father, and who has made me a house, as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death today.
Right now. There's not going to be a trial. There's not going to be bantering. It is clear what his intentions are, and we're dealing with it. And he's right. This is exactly what Adonijah was doing. Okay? 25.
So King Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he struck him down, and he died.
Done. Story over. Okay, so Adonijah was put to death. That's what he wanted. That's what he got. So that's the picture there. And you're going to see Benaiah continue to be a faithful lieutenant or commander, if you will, to Solomon during his reign. Okay, so we're seeing the fruit of what David talked about. Hey, there are going to be some issues. Okay, Adonijah wasn't necessarily one of them, but there were several that were. 26 now, we have another guy that Solomon's got to deal with. Read that.
And to Abiathar the priest of the king said, go to Anathoth, to your own fields, for you are deserving of death, but I will not put you to death too, at this time.
Now, why is who's Abiathar, first of all? He's a priest, okay, and why does Solomon say, I should kill you? What does he have against Abiathar?
He was on Adonijah's side.
When Adonijah rebelled, Joab and Abiathar went with him. They clearly said, we're not on David's team anymore. And Solomon says, you deserve death, okay? However, I'm not going to kill you. Go to your house. I will not put you to death because you carried the ark of the Lord of God before my father David and because you were afflicted in everything in which my father was afflicted. Hey, you served my dad faithfully for a long time, and I respect that. You made a really stupid decision here recently that should deserve death, but I'm going to be gracious. Go home, and we're good. And Abiathar is one of those guys that's like, thank you, we're good. So he goes home, and he makes the most of the opportunity. Solomon dismissed Abiathar from being priest in order to fulfill the word which the Lord had spoken concerning the house of Eli. Eli, when his sons Hophni and Phinehas died, they talked about the priesthood being transferred from Abiathar to Zadok, the new priesthood. It's still within the tribe of Levi, but because of this guy's actions, it is officially switched over. So Abiathar and his family get put on the bench, so there is certainly a consequence to his joining the coup with Adonijah, but his life is spared, and Solomon honors the tenure of faithfulness that he had with his father David. So again, you're seeing Solomon having to weigh decisions. Should I kill him? He deserves it, but man, he's a priest and he's been faithful. What's the right answer? I don't know. Solomon says, I'm going to be gracious where I can be gracious. I tried that with Adonijah. He didn't like that. He took advantage of me. So he's dead. Abiathar is not going to do that. He's going to be cool with that. So he's going to go to his house and live in peace. Okay. Now, verse 28. There's another issue now that Solomon has to deal with.
The news came to Joab for Joab had defected to Adonijah, though he had not defected to Absalom. So Joab fled to the tabernacle of the Lord and took hold of the horns of the altar.
So Joab realizes, man, I'm in trouble. I've joined this coup. I didn't join the one with Absalom, but I did with Adonijah. And he realizes, just like Adonijah, he's dead in the water. So he flees to the same altar and says, you know, I'm just going to ask for grace. And Solomon's now got to figure out, how do I deal with him? So he's dealing with people that are all ultimately could get the same punishment. And he's having to use wisdom to say, how do I discern what needs to happen here? Because some guys need to die. Some guys don't. Some guys need to kind of choose their own adventure ending and figure out for themselves. And he's trying to figure that out. So King Solomon in verse 29 finds out that that's exactly what Joab had done, that he flees to the altar. And he says in verse 29, then Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go fall upon him. I don't care if he's on the altar, right? Run him through. He needs to die. Okay, my dad told me that he's going to be an issue. Use wisdom in dealing with him. He's still, by the way, when Bathsheba comes and asks for the Shunammite bride for Adonijah, did you notice who was still on his team? He mentions Joab and the priest. Like, they've still aligned themselves. So even after, now that David is gone, Joab doesn't repent. He doesn't come back and say, Solomon, I blew it. I'm back on your side. David still sees him, or Solomon still sees him aligned with Adonijah and now the other kings that are seeking the throne. So he says, man, game over with him. So Benaiah goes and says to Joab, thus the king has said, come out. But he said, no, I will die here. Verse 30, Benaiah brought the king word again, saying, man, Joab's like hanging out at the altar. Like, I told him to come out. He said, no, I'm hanging out at the altar. I'm on base. Even Benaiah's like, I'm not going to kill you on the altar. So he goes back to Solomon and says, man, he won't come off the altar. And basically Solomon says, then kill him there. That's fine. So he sends him back. Verse 34, then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and fell upon him and put him to death. And he was buried in his own house in the wilderness. So Benaiah now kills Joab because of the crimes committed underneath David's reign. So he warns him, he tells him, gives him an opportunity to have this done differently. But he executes Joab for his murder in the time of peace and does not overlook that and says, man, that's just too big of an issue. Okay, so we've got three guys that he's dealt with so far. In verse 36 now, we get back to Shammai the cursing mooner. Okay, someone pick up there. Yeah.
What do you think about him killing him in, like, on the altar?
God says that even if he's on the altar, that's okay. The Exodus text says, man, even if there's someone on my altar, you can take their lives. So it's not a violation. In fact, God speaks directly to it. It's unfortunate. It should have been done differently. But Joab was just hoping for something that wasn't coming to him. So you don't see a lot of repentance in him. You just see, I got caught for my actions. Give me grace, though I'm not really repentant of my actions. Okay?
It's not like the city of refuge or something like that.
No, he's not in Hebron. He's not anything like that. So, and Joab didn't honor that so much anyway. That's how, you know, the first lieutenant, the first commander died. So, yeah. Okay? So 36. Let's watch how he deals with Shammai.
Then the king sent and called for Shammai, and he called and he said to him, build yourself a house in Jerusalem and dwell there, and do not go out from there anywhere. For it shall be on the day that you go out and cross the brook of Kidron, know for certain that you shall surely die. Your blood shall be on your own head.
So what does he do with Shammai?
As long as you stay here, you're alive.
Yeah, puts him on house arrest. Okay, so go build a house. He builds a house on the east side of Jerusalem, okay, across the Kidron Valley. And he says, if you leave to the west, like if you come into the city, or if you head east over the Mount of Olives, you're dead. So I'm going to be gracious. My dad told me to deal with you in blood, I think was the word, to not let his gray hair go down the shield without blood or whatever it is. But I'm going to put you on house arrest, okay? So you stay here. You're not a threat to me. No big deal. You stay here and you're fine. And he does that for a little bit, okay? Verse 38, then Shammai said to the king, the word is good. As the king has said, your servant shall do. So Shimei says, great. Man, I'm good with that. So the says Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days, but it came about after 2 years, the servants of Shimei ran away to Achish, the son of Maacah, king of Gath. And then Shimei says, I need to go after my servants who are now over in the Philistines' land to the west. He chases them out, gets his stuff back. Arose, went after his donkey and his servants, and Shimei went down and brought his servants from Gath. So he gets his stuff back and goes back home. And wouldn't you know it, word gets back to Solomon that that's exactly what he does. Okay, 41, it was told that Solomon, that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and he'd returned. So verse 42, watch what Solomon has to do.
Then the king sent and called Shimei and said to him, did I not make you swear by the Lord and warn you, saying, know for certain that on the day that you go out and travel anywhere, you shall surely die. And you said to me, the word that I have heard is good.
You remember that conversation that we had, by the way, 2 years ago, when I said this to you? You said this, I said this. Do you remember that, Shimei? Was I not clear? You were clear in your response. Keep going.
Why then have you not kept the oath of the Lord and the commandment that I have gave you? Then the king said moreover to Shimei, you know, as your heart acknowledges, all the wickedness that you did to my father David. Therefore, the Lord will return your wickedness on your own head.
So, man, you forced my hand. I gave you an opportunity. You blew it. Verse 46, the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went down and fell upon him so that he died. So, man, that's your choice, bro. So if that's how you want to roll, that's how we'll roll. So you're seeing, again, Solomon as a 21-year-old young man executing now justice and wisdom with the gifts that God has given him, that David has now affirmed in him, having to deal with numerous issues as soon as he gets on the throne. So the kingdom was established in the hands of Solomon. So because he's handled himself rightly, because the people see him as just and fair when he can be, yet when he has to bring the hammer, he'll bring the hammer. But he doesn't abuse that power, right? He's gracious in the way he operates, and that's kind of a last resort, but he's not afraid to act when he has to. Solomon starts really well, okay? And we're seeing that begin to build. 3 verse 1, Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. So this is a sign of one of the things that Solomon is doing. Why would you form a marriage alliance with the king of Egypt and take his daughter as your wife? One of your wives. What's the purpose of this?
Create an alliance between the two
people. Yeah. This is an old school peace treaty, okay? Instead of the UN getting together and everybody getting in a room and, you know, Kerry leading it, for, you know, or whatever, and signing the document saying we're all going to, this is how they did it. You take my daughter, okay? She's going to live in your kingdom. I'm not going to attack you. You're not going to attack me. We're going to trade back and forth. We're at peace. We're good. I got what I need. You got what you need. Let's call it good. And that's what they do, okay? We're going to find out that Pharaoh in chapter 9 is going to give a gift to Solomon. We'll see what that is here later. But he's forming alliances. So, in a sense, it's wise, right? You're creating peace, so let's not fight anymore. Let's call it good. And Solomon's going to do that, by the way, with everyone around him. Solomon's not a man of war. That's not his desire. He's going to create peace around him. Now, what's the problem that comes with that?
Compromise.
There's going to be the temptation to compromise. So at this point in the game, he's not there, but you're seeing evidences of, man, if this is going to be your bargaining tool at the table for every country that you're dealing with, that you need to exchange, you know, a wife for a peace treaty. What, by the way, does the daughter of Pharaoh bring with her into Solomon's kingdom, would you guess? Other gods? You think she worships Ra, the sun god, and Hapi, the god of the Nile, and. Okay, and that's just Egypt. So what happens when you bring in so-and-so from Sidon, and so-and-so from Syria, and the gods that they worship? What is Solomon left to do? How does he appease now his wives? I worship the Lord Yahweh, but you worship Ra, and you worship Chemosh, and you worship Molech, and y'all are all mad at each other, and ooh, I don't want a cat fight, so what do I do? We'll find out what Solomon does. Okay, so there's potential issues that Solomon doesn't recognize that these alliances bring. They're going to cause him problems. Not yet, but it's coming. Okay, now, the wisdom of Solomon is about to get put on display in an amazing way in 2 and following. So you're going to see what David saw in this guy that makes him a brilliant, brilliant king. Okay? Pick up there in 3 verse 2. Isn't that odd? So where are the people sacrificing to God right now? Yeah, on the altars, right? So the high places. High places were often a place where pagans would sacrifice their gods and build their altars. Solomon had removed those, and they're worshiping there. Turn real quick to 2 Chronicles chapter 1. Again, this is just fascinating to me. We mentioned it before, but 2 Chronicles 1 spells it out so clearly. Again, the Chronicles are the same story of the kings from a different perspective. 2 Chronicles picks up on the story of Solomon, okay, with his reign. So just as a reminder as to what's going on, 2 verse 1, sorry, chapter 1, verse 1, not 2 verse 1. Solomon, the son of David, established himself securely over the kingdom, and the Lord, his God, was with him and exalted him greatly. Solomon spoke to all of Israel in verse 2, the commandments of thousands and hundreds to the judges and every leader and all the Israel and the heads of the father's households. Then Solomon and all the assembly went with him to the high place, which was at Gibeon, okay, to the tent, to God's tent of meeting, for God's tent of meeting was there, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, had made in the wilderness. So what are we talking about here in verse 3 very clearly? The tabernacle. So it's right around the corner from Jerusalem. And they would go there to worship the Lord. However, David, in verse 4, brought the Ark of God from Kiriath Yearim to the place that he had prepared for it, for he had pitched a tent for it in Jerusalem. Like, there's no mystery as to where the tabernacle is. They know where it is. The elements of worship, aside from the Ark, are also there with it in Gibeon. But for whatever reason, they're separate. So Solomon is worshiping there in that area because that's kind of the logistics. Solomon is going to say, man, that's not going to work. We need to bring it all together. Okay, we're going to make a temple. We're going to be done with this 500-year-old tent that Moses built, right? That's all ragtag and needs to be patched. We're going to make God a house. Whether or not that was God's heart, you can figure that out, but that's kind of where they're at. Okay, so Solomon basically begins to continue his worship there. It's a good thing. There's no knock on him for doing that. It's just odd that they know where all these things are and just aren't fully worshiping God, and a guy like David wouldn't have put these pieces together, okay? So Solomon now has God appear to him in verse 5 at Gibeon. Watch this.
At Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream by night, and God said, ask what I shall give you. Solomon said,
all right, hold on real quick. So God shows up to Solomon in a dream at night, and what does he say? Interpret, put that in a Living Bible. What do you want? Okay? That's called a blank check. Okay? Solomon, what do you want? Now think about this. You're a dude. You're 21 years old. You're ruling the most powerful nation in the world. And God says, here's a blank check. Whatever you want is yours. What are you asking for? Be honest. 21-year-old guy. I'm asking for money, I'm asking for fame, I'm asking for riches, I'm asking for all the things that would gratify my flesh. Solomon, at 21, says, you know what? That's not what God wants. Watch what he asked for.
And Solomon said, you have shown great and steadfast love to your servant David, my father, because he walked before you in faithfulness, in righteousness, and in the uprightness of heart toward you. And you've kept for him great and steadfast love, and have given him a son to sit on his throne this day.
How about that? I mean, that's in perspective, right? Lord, you've done all this. You were gracious to my dad. I'm only here because of you. This is ridiculous. And you have allowed me to sit in this position. You see the humility in this guy? Even with his wisdom, even with his power, there's just a boatload of humility in him. Now in verse 7, you'll see it even more so.
And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of David my father. Although I am but a little child, I do not know how to go out or come in.
What does that mean? I'm a little child, I do not know how to go out or how to come in. But again, put that in a Living Bible for me. What is he saying?
I don't know what I'm doing.
I have no clue what I'm doing. I'm 21. You've put me in charge of millions of people. I don't have the first clue, God, how to rule. That's an Wow, that is an honest statement. Now, he's wise, but he's also confessing his own inadequacies. Lord, I don't know how to do this. I don't know what I'm doing. So, keep reading, Cass.
And your servant is in the midst of your people whom you have chosen, a great people, too many to be numbered or counted for multitude.
So here's what he asked for.
Give your servant, therefore, an understanding mind to govern your people, that I may discern between good and evil. For who is able to govern this, your great people?
Now, man, if you're God, what are you thinking right now? Absolutely. Thank you. You're humble. You're honest. You're walking with me. You're confessing your own inadequacies. Absolutely. You think God's going to give him wisdom? Yeah, I'll give you a boatload because your heart's in the right spot. And not only that, watch what God says. Verse 10, it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked for this thing. Solomon, you had a blank check. You could have been selfish, but you were selfless. You asked for the right thing. And man, I love that. And God says in verse 11.
And God said to him, because you have asked this and have not asked for yourself long life or riches or the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself understanding to discern what is right, behold, I now do according to your world. Behold, I give you a wise and discerning mind, so that none like you has been before. You and none like you shall arise after you.
Nobody will ever be as wise as you. I will give you exactly what you asked for, because that honors me. Your prayer honors me, but not just that.
I give you also what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that no other king shall compare with you all your days.
Now, what does God know in the midst of Solomon's prayer?
What he wants, riches and honor.
Did he ever ask for that? No. But God says, man, I know that's a desire of yours, and because you weren't selfish and didn't ask for that, I will give you this as well. What does that tell you about our prayer life with God? Does God not only know the things that we communicate to him, but also the desires of our heart, what our intentions are? That's not necessarily wicked and evil, right? Because God wouldn't have granted that if that were so, but he's saying, man, my needs are subservient to the needs of the people, and what the people needs, what the people needs is a godly, a humble, wise king. And I'm not that. I'm 21. I don't know how to do this. I'm not my father David. Can you imagine stepping into David's shoes, by the way? How intimidating that would be to rule. Holy cow, right? That's Moses and Joshua all over again. The people love David. So God gives him the desires of his heart, which is great. So even when we don't know how to articulate to God what is on our heart, how to pray rightly, God says, man, I know, I'm there, I'm with you, and he grants Solomon that, which is amazing. So his man, I will give you that, verse 14, if
you will walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked then.
What is he saying? Man, you want to be wise and discerning and rich and all of it? What do you have to do? The same thing that your daddy told you. Just walk with me. Be obedient and walk with me, right? It's as easy as that. Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord and gave burnt offerings and made peace offerings and made a feast for all his servants. So he celebrates this word from God. They give offerings now, and Solomon is blessed beyond belief. And you're going to see God continue to bless this guy. Okay. Now, verse 16 and following, we get a snippet. We get a story. You've all heard this, of how Solomon executes his wisdom. Okay. Two women come to Solomon. They're described in verse 16 as harlots, and they have an issue, okay? They both have sons, newborn kids. One rolls over on her son in the middle of the night and accidentally kills him, and goes, wakes up and realizes her son's dead, switches sons with the other woman who's still asleep, and then wakes up, and the actual mother of the living son realizes, man, this isn't my kid. You've given me your dead kid, and you've taken my alive kid. They go back and forth, can't figure it out, and bring this case to Solomon. How do we figure this out? So, Solomon says, verse 23, the one says, this is my son who is living and your son is dead. The other says, no, this is my son who is dead and my son is the living one. So Solomon says, okay, the only way I can figure out who the real mother is this. Watch what he does. 24. Now, if you're the mother of the living child, What are you going to say when Solomon says that?
I want the top half.
What can I throw at you? I want the top half. Wow. Oh, boy. Yeah, you're the mom. You would say, look, it'd be better for my kid to go be with another mother than to be dead, right? So... That is a jaded Sunday school answer right there. I kind of like it, but I know that's not right. So that's exactly what Solomon realizes. And the one says, oh, my Lord, give her the living child. And the other mom, gosh, how hard are you when you say, yeah. The other said, he shall be neither mine nor yours. Cut him in half. Like, what a nasty woman, right? Golly. So the king said, give the first woman the living child, for by no means kill him. She is his mother. Solomon had no intention of killing this child. He just needed to discern who was the true mother. And that's exactly what happened. So, like, man, that's actually brilliant, Solomon. I would have never thought of that, but that's exactly what happens. Okay? So, one example of his wisdom. Okay? Verse 4 now, or chapter 4 and following, you're going to see Solomon now begin to administrate his kingdom. And this is brilliant. Okay? Solomon realizes, man, I have 1.3 million fighting dudes, right, from David's census that was not good, but at least he has a number now, plus all these people. He says, man, to God, the people are too numerous. I can't even number them. He realizes, sitting in Jerusalem, man, I can't effectively govern these people. So Solomon now is king, verse 2. These were his officials. The first person who's mentioned here, Azariah, the son of Zadok, who's now the new priest. So Solomon has a priest on his cabinet, if you will, his inside team. Other guys here are mentioned. Verse 4, you get Benaiah, who's over his army. You get verse 5, Zabdab, the son of Nathan, a priest, who was the king's friend. So you get an advisor, a counselor, who's the son of Nathan. What is Solomon doing? Who is he bringing into his inner circle? A priest, Benaiah. A loyal and faithful counselor whose word is true, who's not afraid to communicate truth to the king. Is he surrounding himself with a bunch of yes men? No, he's getting the right people on his team that can speak truth into his life, that can lead. He gets Abda, verse 6, who's over the men subject to forced labor. So this is David's guy that was in charge of the forced labor. You're going to see a number of times that the forced labor that Solomon uses, at least initially, were people that they had come in from other lands. He's not using Israelites yet, but he's going to. So this was probably not the smartest move. Verse 7, Solomon had 12 deputies over all of Israel. What do you suppose their job was? 12 deputies. Yeah, so each one of you is going to be a governor of a tribe. You're going to oversee what's happening in Dan, because that's way up north in the Galilee. I don't know what's going on up there, okay? So you're going to communicate to me. So he's ruling wisely, and he's getting a big team around him that can help him do that, okay? So brilliant the way he's doing that. Verse 20, watch the situation that unfolds because of how Solomon is ruling. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand on the seashore. In abundance, they were eating and drinking and rejoicing. So what kind of conditions is Solomon ruling in, or what kind of conditions is he creating? There's peace. Not just peace, but you're going to see prosperity in the land like we've never seen it before, okay? Solomon ruled all the nations from the river of the land of the Philistines, so that's the Mediterranean Sea, to the land of the border of Egypt, so all the way down to Egypt, and they served Solomon all the days of his life. Solomon's provision, you're going to see in 22, they give some numbers of all the stuff that he gets as part of his kingly allowance. Verse 24, he had dominion over everything from the river Tipsah even to Gaza, over all the things of the West River. He had peace on all sides around him. 25, Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under the vine and the fig tree from Dan to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. How do you feel about Solomon as some Danite in the kingdom? No. Dude, there's peace. There's prosperity. The economy's good. We love you. We're not at war. You're not whipping us yet. This is a good time. Like, Solomon is ruling wisely. This is prosperity, by the way, that we've never seen before in terms of the land and the amount of peace that they have. Maybe not godliness. David was pretty high on that reign. But in terms of the amount of stuff that they have, it's amazing. So, yeah.
How would you compare this to, like, you call it the Camelot period, I think?
Yeah. David? I think David's godliness factor was higher in that sense. He was ruling towards the end of his reign, or in that kind of middle season of his reign, if you will, with a godliness aspect that doesn't ever get touched. And that's why he's a guy that everyone's going to be measured against. Solomon's doing that. What Solomon's able to do differently is acquire land and acquire peace. David never had peace like this, at least to the widespread peace. Solomon's going to push himself like close to the Euphrates River in terms of what he's controlling. I mean, it's big, way bigger than that God even talked about the boundaries in Genesis chapter 12. So land and wealth, Solomon's got David beat. Godliness, I would say David had a reign that was like none other. Okay, so that's a great question because I think that's a fair comparison. Now, 26, just as like one of those, oh, by the ways, read that.
Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen.
Now, what does that trigger in your mind when you hear that? Like, huh. Is that a lot? I mean, would that qualify? Deuteronomy 17 is do not multiply yourselves wealth, horses, or wives. 40,000? I mean, that's a lot, right? How many Ferraris do you really need, right? One, two, 40,000? Solomon is going to have to go build more cities that have horse stalls in them because he can't contain them in Jerusalem. And he's being wise and fortifying cities all over Israel. So is he acquiring for himself more? Yeah. Is it an issue now?
No.
Not yet. But it will be, and you're seeing the signs of it.
Yeah, I have a question about God on that. So, like, back to the last, or when he asked him the question, like, what do you want? He said, I want wisdom, and God says, oh, I'm going to give you more riches. But ultimately, riches is kind of what destroys Solomon. Why would God give something to someone that he didn't ask for that's going to basically destroy him?
And therein lies the fallacy. It's not riches that destroy Solomon. It's not women that destroy Solomon. We'll get to it. Okay, so it's not God. It's causing his downfall, okay? And we'll see what that is. Now, there are certainly things that contribute to that, but these things are going to reveal something within Solomon that's already there. We'll get to it, okay? But I think it's a great question to ask because it does certainly seem like, man, if Solomon couldn't handle this, why in the world would God continue to load the deck, right, and above the waterline if he knew that he couldn't handle it below the waterline, right? It's a fair question. So, but let's get there, okay? Lord willing, we'll get there today, okay? God gave in verse 29, Solomon, wisdom, very great discernment, a breadth of mind like the sand on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east, for he was wiser than all men. I mean, my goodness, can you imagine having that etched on your tombstone? You are the smartest dude that's ever lived. The wisest guy. It's amazing. He spoke 3,000 Proverbs in verse 32. He wrote songs. Listen to this. It's not just that he knows about Bible. He spoke of trees. He's a botanist. Of cedar that is in Lebanon. So he knows about life. He knows about agriculture. He knows about verse 33. He spoke of animals and birds and creeping things on the earth and fish. He came. Men came from all over the earth to hear Solomon's wisdom in verse 34. The kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. So people are literally coming to him, and it's not just about biblical things. It's about, he's just wise in life. He knows about he's brilliant. So God is giving him exactly what he asked for and then some, okay? Now, 5 and 6 and following, Solomon's now going to begin to make preparation for the temple, okay? So we are probably about 6 years into Solomon's reign at this point. Solomon now decides it's time to build the temple. The temple is going to take 20 years to complete, okay? When you think about that in Fresno, how long does it take to put up an office building or a house? I mean, if they're jamming 3 or 4, if they're slow, 6 months. We talked about it at the well as we're talking about buildings and stuff. Like, I mean, if you've got to go acquire a piece of dirt from that day to a finished product that you're living in, maybe a year and a half, okay? 20 years he's going to take building this thing. And it's not big in terms of what Herod will do to it, but it is ostentatious beyond belief, okay? So chapter 5 is all about him making preparations for that. Solomon goes to Hiram, king of Tyre, who's David's buddy in the north. There are basically no trees in Israel. Not none, but there's very few. They have to be imported. There are there now because they've planted them. But Hiram is basically the guy that's got cedar trees in abundance in Lebanon. He strikes a deal with Hiram and says, hey, drop some trees in the Mediterranean Sea for me or on the river. Float them down to me. I'm going to use your cedar trees to build the temple. So he's putting all these things together. He tells Hiram, king of Tyre, what his desires are. Hiram says, man, that's great. Verse 10, Hiram gave Solomon as much as he desired, the cedar and cypress lumber or timber. So he's blessed there. Verse 13, King Solomon levied forced laborers from all Israel. They numbered 30,000 men. He sent them to Lebanon, 10,000 a month in relays. They were in Lebanon a month, in 2 months at home. So he would send these men up to go get the timber and bring it down the river. Solomon had 70,000 transporters, 80,000 hewers of stone. He has 80,000 stonemasons to build a building. I mean, can you imagine how intricate that is? How crazy that is when you have that many people that are literally hand chiseling stone to build a building, okay? So this thing is off the charts in terms of the temple that he's going to build, okay? Insane. 6 and following, you get a description. We won't go through all of this, but it basically says 6 verse 1, in the 480th year after the sons of Israel came out of the land of Egypt, which is amazing with that kind of detail, that they came out in 446 BC, which is when we believe they came out. This is now 966 BC. Okay, so we're again 6 years into Solomon's reign. It's about 1000 BC, 966 to be exact, where Solomon begins the construction of this temple. 6, chapter 7, and chapter 8 are all the building of the temple, all the things that go into it. Okay, so it's kind of like reading the end of Exodus, where a third of the book is about the blueprints of the tabernacle. This part is the building of the temple. Okay, so I want to kind of get to the meatier stuff, if you will. Okay, so they build the temple. It takes 20 years to build. By chapter 8, they're going to finish here in, oh, what is it? Chapter 9, verse 10 will be done, but chapter 8 is basically the dedication of the temple. So just like we had a dedication of the tabernacle when Moses finished it, they're going to have a party. Chapter 8, they're going to have a party, and it's amazing. Solomon is basically going to pray, God, would you please inhabit this place? Forgive the sins of the people when they pray. But he's begging now, Lord, we built this house. Now will you come live in it? Will you honor this? Is this your desire? Okay. So they bring in the Ark of God, 8 verse 1, out of the city of David. They take it out of the tent that David had built for it. They put it in there. Verse 4, they brought the Ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the holy utensils which were in the tent. And the priests and the Levites brought them up. So they bring all the elements of the tabernacle finally back together. It's been hundreds of years since this is happening. Verse 5, it says, they sacrificed so many sheep and oxen that they could not be counted. And you're going to get a number here later of like the additional sheep and oxen that were sacrificed that are mind-blowing. Okay, so they bring all this stuff back. Verse 11, watch what happens now that they get all this stuff assembled. Solomon prays that God would show up, and look what happens. 8 verse 11, read that.
So that the priests could not continue ministering because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord.
Sorry, in verse 10 it says, it came about when the priests had come from the holy place that the Lord, the cloud, filled the temple. They literally had to leave because God showed up. So this place is blessed by God. Solomon, from this point forward in verse 12 and following, just basically issues a prayer. And he basically says, God, this is a place where we need your presence to dwell. When we blow it and when we sin, would you forgive us? Would you use the elements of the tabernacle that are now here? And we're going to walk with you. And can we reenact, basically, the system that we had in the wilderness? Can we do that here? And he just prays that God would do that, that God would forgive sin, that he would keep his covenant with them. Even when they're idiots, that they would be blessed by God, that God would allow repentance. And the rest of chapter 8 is just Solomon praying this very, very righteous prayer that God would show up and that God would move. And in 8, for the rest of the chapter, you can kind of look through it. I mean, it's just Solomon's amazing prayer, okay? God blesses this. Verse 62 of chapter 8, The king and all of Israel offered sacrifices before the Lord. Listen to this. Verse 63 of chapter 8. Solomon offered for sacrifice a peace offering, which he had offered to the Lord, 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. So the king and all the sons of Israel dedicated the house of the Lord. 120,000 sheep. I mean, that's a grip of sheep, yes? Like, can you imagine that many sacrificed sheep? How big is this pile of sheep on an altar, right? So you get the idea of the grandiosity of Solomon's vision and what they tried to do, and they did it, okay? They party now for basically 7 days, and on the eighth day in verse 66, he sent the people away and blessed the king, said, go to your house, celebrate, and God has now filled the temple. I mean, this is great. So we're 25, 26, 27 years into Solomon's reign. He's built himself a house. He's fortified cities across his nation. He has peace everywhere. They have money in abundance. He's built God a house, God show. I mean, this is amazing, okay? Everything seems to be going according to plan, okay? Came about 9 verse 1, when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord, that the king's house and all that Solomon desired to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon now a second time. So he showed up to Solomon in a dream when he was 21 and says, dude, blank check, what do you want? Solomon said, give me wisdom. And now he says in verse 2, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time when he was at Gibeon. The Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication, which you have made before me. I have consecrated this house, which you have built by putting my name there forever in my eyes, and my heart will be there perpetually. So Solomon, your amazing prayer in verse 8, chapter 8 rather, I heard it. I'm going to show up. As for you, verse 4, if you will walk before me as your father David walked, in integrity of heart, uprightness, doing according to all that I have commanded you, and will keep my statutes and ordinances, then I will establish the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever. Solomon, we're good. Okay? You've blessed me. I'll live in this house. Maybe not my first desire, but man, this will work. Your heart's in the right spot. And Solomon, if we can keep walking down this path, you walk with me, I'll bless you. We'll continue to do this. So it is amazing. And God responds and says, man, game on, we're good. Okay. However, verse 6, if you don't, and you choose to be an idiot, and you want to do something wrong, like worship other gods, verse 7, I will cut off Israel from the land which I have given them, to the house which I have consecrated for my name. I will cast you out of my sight, so that Israel will become a proverb and a byword among the people, meaning people will mock you. They will hear the word Israel and they will laugh because of the destruction and the calamity that I will bring. Verse 8, this house, Solomon, that you've spent 20 years building will become a heap of ruins. Everyone who passes by will be astonished and hiss and say, why has the Lord done this to this land and to this house? Meaning, I don't care about this house. What I care more about is your obedience and the obedience of the people, and I will knock this thing down tomorrow if you stop walking with me and this nation stops walking with me, okay? But God says this can work. So obviously we know the end game, okay? God brings in Babylon in 586 BC, and they destroy this temple that Solomon builds because of the actions of Solomon that are coming, okay? So far, so good. He's given a warning, but man, right now, we're in a good spot, okay? Verse 10 and following is kind of interesting. Solomon, basically, over the last 20 years, has completely drained his bank account because he's had to pay for this tabernacle, or temple, rather. I don't have a number on what it would be currently, but it is, he spent a grip of money on this, okay? So as a result, instead of paying Hiram King of Tyre, who gave him all the cedar trees from Lebanon and cut those down and had workers do this for him, he pays him in cities. It's kind of an odd deal. He gives him part of Israel, which is kind of odd. So not a wise move on his behalf. It's again, speaking of something like Solomon, you're giving away God's land because you've drained your bank account. Verse 12, Hiram came from Tyre to see the cities which Solomon had given to him, and they did not please him. He gave him basically part of the Galilee, the upper land of the Galilee, which in certain times in history has basically been like flooded and underwater. So he kind of gave Solomon like the Everglades, like they're underwater and useless until you can figure out how to deal with them properly. Their lands where Dan lives in. So he gives them all away. Hiram saw it, was like, man, this is awful. Dude, you gave me the armpit of Israel. Like, why would I want that? So he gives him gold in exchange for it, but basically kind of communicates his displeasure. Okay. chapter or 9, verse 16, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, with their marriage alliance, had gone up and captured Gezer, one of the gateway cities in Israel. Gezer, Bethshemesh, Azekah, Lachish, you guys have heard about before. And he burned it with fire, killed the Canaanites who lived there, and then gave Gezer back to Solomon as a dowry for Solomon's wife. So Solomon acquires a city within his own area that he hadn't fortified and hadn't built. The king of Egypt comes in and does the dirty work for him and then gives him the city. So that's how he acquires Gezer. Solomon now rebuilds it and makes it a significant city. And there's a couple other cities where Solomon is mentioned here in the text that we didn't read, but they're cities of great fortification. Hazor up in the north is where he puts a bunch of his chariots. He's got Megiddo, the city of where Armageddon's going to take place. There's one more, and I can't remember the name of it right now. But anyway, he builds these fortified cities for protection all over Israel so that he's got troops and so on and so forth. Okay, verse 22, just note this. Solomon did not make slaves of the sons of Israel, for they were men of war, his servants and his princes and his captains and his chariots and his commanders. So at this point in the game, he hasn't made it difficult on Israel. He's used outside labor for the most part. And the people are pleased with him overall. So as you're getting just, again, a taste of what's happening in Israel, man, Solomon is ruling thus far in godliness. He's probably three quarters of the way through his life, through his reign, if you will. And man, everything seems to be great, but you're seeing signs. You're seeing elements that go, man, that's a lot of wives. And we'll see that in a second. That's a lot of horses and stalls and that sort of thing. And that's certainly a lot of money. Okay. Solomon does something in verse 26 that we've never seen before. This is crazy. Solomon also built a fleet of ships. So we've never seen Israel with a navy. He builds a navy in the city of Eilat down south at the Gulf of Aqaba. And it says in verse 28, they went to Ophir, which is basically modern-day Saudi Arabia in the Arabian Peninsula, hundreds of miles south. And they took 400 in verse 28. 420 talents of gold. I've got a note on that. That's 15.75 tons of gold. So though Solomon has drained his bank account, he's now going out and getting more money. And because of the peace that he has, these alliances are paying him money in full. So he's getting a ton of cash to replenish kind of the wealth that he has now drained. Okay. By the way, real quick, look at... Well, you know what? Let's stop there. So we'll kind of see Solomon's downfall after this, and we'll pick up in chapter 10 next Thursday. But you're seeing so far so good with elements of potential problems, but 10 and falling, we're about to see this thing fall apart.
What's that part where it says that David couldn't build the temple because he's like a man of bullshit?
We skipped it. It's back here. I think it's in it's in 5 or 6. It's in that portion. I'll mention it. I'll look for it. We'll pick it up on next Thursday. So, but yeah, it's in that text. It's I think when he's talking to Hiram, king of Tyre, about his desires to build a temple, and he tells him why. He says, "My dad couldn't, but I could." So, yeah. Okay. All right, gang. Have a great weekend. We'll see you on Thursday.